Okay, I'm going to start just by thanking Joe for putting this symposium together. He did a lot of hard and good work, and it was really, really nice of him to do that. I also want to thank Sarah that helped bring me here today, and also Organic Valley, which helped fund some of the research that I'm going to be talking about today. So, this paper originates in a series of conversations with an organic dairy farmer named Jack Laser, who with his wife Anne owns and runs Butterworks Farm in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom, just a few miles from the Quebec border. Established in 1975, Butterworks was Vermont's first certified organic dairy, setting a trend that has had a major impact on the state's agricultural economy and identity. There are now more than 200 certified organic dairies in Vermont. Today, Jack and Anne milk a closed herd of 45 Jerseys, grow all their own feed and forages, and sell their all-natural yogurt and heavy cream throughout the Northeast. They also grow a wide range of grains and seeds for human consumption, including dry beans, corn, wheat, oats, rye, barley, triticale, buckwheat, canola, and sunflower. When I met Jack first in 2006, it didn't take long for us to discover a shared interest in old agricultural books. Jack described to me how he first got interested in agricultural history as an undergraduate at Tufts, worked for a summer at Old Sturbridge Village in western Massachusetts, and then spent a year reading his way through the S stacks at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Library while waiting for Anne, his then future wife, to finish her senior year. As Jack explained it to me, this reading, in combination with regular help and advice from older neighbors on both sides of the international border, formed the basis for Butterworks Farm's success. Neither he nor Anne came from a farming family. As Jack put it, between the old books and the old timers, I really got my foundation. More than 30 years later, Jack and Anne's home library includes titles such as Thomas Hunt's The Cereals in America, 1904, Ford S. Prince's Grassland Farming in the Humid Northeast, 1956, Clarence Eccles' Dairy Cattle and Milk Production from 1911, and Charles William Burkitt's The Farmer's Veterinarian from 1909, not just as historical curiosities, but as regularly consulted tools for organic farm management. This and later conversations got me thinking about the uses of old farming books by pioneering organic farmers and what questions this use might pose for agricultural historiography. Based on my own acquaintance within the organic farming community, I knew that the Lasers were not alone in these habits. Other successful organic farmers regularly cite the influence of historical information on their farm's development. And here I came across this the other day, an example from the old New Farm magazine sort of mentioning this same process as a sort of standard set of strategies that organic farmers in the early years, in the 1980s and before, pursued in order to figure out what to do. Originally, this was based on necessity, a response to the absence of help, often active discouragement, on offer from standard information resources like the Extension Service and the land-grant universities. But the strategy has persisted, even as significant numbers of extension and university researchers have begun to endorse organic methods. In the Midwest, organic hog farmers are exploring historic feed ration recipes as a way of finding more economical feeds better suited to the breeds and production systems they're working with. In New England, organic grain farmers are seeking to recover old grain varieties adapted to Northeast growing conditions. Other examples could be given. In a sense, the fact that organic farming relies in a unique way on its bibliographic resource is not surprising. One of the most interesting, perhaps essential, characteristics of successful organic farmers is their intellectual curiosity. Habits of careful observation, a readiness to exchange information with others, and a desire to be continually learning are all traits widely recognized and cultivated within the organic farming community. This intellectual curiosity manifests itself not just in direct observation of the agroecological systems under their management, but in an interplay between firsthand empirical observation and the omnivorous consultation of a wide range of written and oral resources, both historical and contemporary. Organic farming, in other words, is information-based farming, an agriculture that, as advocates like to point out, in its ideal form, rewards producers for their knowledge rather than for their ability to purchase and supply materials. Information inputs help me focus on cause correction, writes the celebrated organic farmer Elliot Coleman in his book, The New Organic Grower, whereas product inputs only encourage symptom treatment. But what, I wondered, is the broader significance of this peculiarly literate or intellectual nature of the organic farming movement? How does organic farmers' use of old farming books, for instance, compare to the genealogies of organic farming offered by Philip Conford, Randall Beeman, Joseph Heckman, and others? Is there a distinction to be drawn between the ideological history of organic farming, the history of organic farming as an idea, and the practical history of organic farming, the history of organic farming as it has been developed in practice? If so, how does the one inform the other? And finally, what relationship does this alternative agricultural history bear to mainstream or conventional agricultural history? To begin to answer these questions, I interviewed four organic farmers about their favorite books and other information sources, past and present. Reasoning that farmers managing farm operations of different types would have distinct perspectives on the agricultural literature, I chose one farmer from each of four organic sectors: dairying mixed grain, grass-fed beef, tree fruits, and vegetables. These interviews were not intended to provide a comprehensive view of organic farmers' use of information resources. Rather, the goal was to engage a small number of prominent organic practitioners in a discussion about the relationship between alternative farming systems and what might be called the agricultural archive. I should note that throughout this paper, I use the term organic in its broad and historical sense, meaning not just certified organic producers in keeping with the USDA National Organic Program, but producers committed to farming according to biological and ecological principles of soil, plant, and animal health, and eschewing the use of chemical pesticides and synthetic fertilizers. So in this sense, I consider the term organic agriculture to be more or less interchangeable with alternative agriculture or sustainable agriculture. Before proceeding to the interview summaries, I just want to note two other rather different projects that have sought to identify historical agricultural material of relevance to contemporary alternative farming endeavors. The first began in 1997 when the North Central SARE program awarded a grant to a group of researchers at Kansas State University to undertake a survey of historic KSU extension materials of possible use to contemporary sustainable farmers. The objective of this project, according to the final report, was to systematically collect, select, and compile the early literature on farming systems for sustainable agriculture for easy access by farmers, extension specialists, and scientists, both in paper copy and electronically in a searchable database. Project staff reviewed 2,324 extension bulletins published by KSU Extension between 1888 and 1956. Of these, they identified 177 that seemed to pertain to sustainable agriculture, 68 of which were particularly relevant to today's farming practices. Most of this latter group were digitized, and farmer and project participant Lisa French then wrote a series of really fantastic summary articles based on what she identified as four topical clusters: agroforestry and high-value crops, cover crops, agronomic weed and pest management, and soil management. Emerging from this select group with links to digitized versions of the original bulletins throughout. The second historical alternative agriculture literature project has been spearheaded by the good people at the Alternative Farming Systems Information Center at the National Ag Library in Beltsville. Beginning in 2005, AFSIC staff launched a digitization project known as Organic Roots, uploading nearly 200 pre-1942 USDA publications to a searchable database. The articles are drawn from two series, the USDA Technical Bulletins and USDA Farmers Bulletins. Most date from the 1930s. They address such topics as experiments on breeding corn, corn resistant to the European corn borer, reducing decay in citrus fruits with borax, and the composition and properties of goat's milk as compared with cow's milk. As with the Kansas effort, however, researchers quickly discovered that while there was certainly some fascinating material here, the majority of the old bulletins, despite dating from before the so-called chemical era, was not suitable to today's organic regime, for instance, because of references made to prohibited materials like arsenic. There seems, in other words, to be a recurring impulse among those working in organic and sustainable agriculture to look to historic farming systems and the research communities associated with them for ideas relevant to the contemporary context. I think this session today is evidence of that as well. Indeed, organic advocates frequently seek to combat the notion that organic agriculture is fundamentally backward or Luddite in its allegiances, a caricature that in itself invites closer scrutiny, as it may, like many caricatures, be based on certain recognizable features. The challenge here is to discern the truly relevant alternative agricultural archive within the enormous body of historical agricultural writing, particularly in the more recent periods from the late 19th through the mid-20th centuries. My idea, then, was to engage existing organic farmers' expertise as a guide to the archive rather than the other way around, to ask pioneering organic farmers about their actual practical use of early agricultural books as aids for sustainable farming. Ultimately, such an effort points towards an alternative history of organic farming, one based not simply on the evolution of non-chemical farming as an idea, but as complex, multiple elaborations of biological farming systems within specific geographic and ecological constraints. So now I'm going to talk about, I've already told you everything you're going to hear about the Lasers and Butterworks Farm. Unfortunately, there's more to say, but I'm just going to tell you about the three other folks that I've talked to, some of whom I'm sure you're familiar with. Based in Rosebud, Arkansas, Gerald Fry operates a consulting business called Bovine Engineering, which, despite its rather high-tech-sounding name, teaches methods for evaluating beef cattle based on measurable phenotypic traits. Fry is critical of what he calls the bigger is better movement in the beef cattle industry, centered on feedlot management, and focuses instead on breeding for optimum performance within grass-based systems. After years of research, travel, and evaluation of herds throughout the United States and abroad, Fry has concluded that the Devon breed, first brought to America, he notes, in 1623, most frequently offers the best combination of traits. Fry cites as a formative influence the work of a South African researcher named John Bonsma, author of a book titled Man Must Measure, which describes 14 specific measurements, including chest girth and hide thickness, for evaluating the quality and breeding potential of a given animal. Fry met and studied with Bonsma in the early 1970s, but his research has also taken him deeper into the history of livestock husbandry. He has studied successive editions of standard livestock breeding textbooks and noted the changes from decade to decade. Among his favorite authors is a French dairy scientist named François Guénon, who in the early 19th century developed a new set of standards for evaluating the quality of milk cows based on the hair swirl patterns around the animal's tail and rump. "You will literally get laughed at," Fry told me, "but it's the most important thing to know." Fry is also a fan of the famous 18th century English livestock breeder Robert Bakewell, known for his pioneering emphasis on inbreeding as a strategy for rapidly developing desired characteristics in sheep and cattle. Bakewell wrote no books, but Fry told me that a group in England recently collected and published some of Bakewell's notebook materials, which I believe is the New Dishley Society, which is a Leicestershire-based group dedicated to promoting the legacy of Bakewell, their native son. In 2003, Fry teamed up with Ridgway Shin, founding director of the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, the American Milking Devon Association, and the New England Livestock Alliance, and Chuck Lacey, a venture capitalist and former president of Ben & Jerry's, to create the Bakewell Reproductive Center, which sells beef and semen and offers workshops in livestock evaluation methods with an emphasis on Angus and Devon lines selected for grass utilization, high butterfat milk, and tender meat with high levels of intermuscular fat. Fry's career offers a good illustration of how pioneering organic and sustainable farmers combine key agricultural ideas from the past, sometimes considered heretical by mainstream practitioners, with new marketing opportunities to create innovative systems that look both backwards and forwards. The Bakewell Reproductive Center sells copies of Guénon's On Milch Cows, a treatise upon the bovine species in general, in an American edition translated by Thomas Hand and published by Orange Judd in 1913, as well as of Fry's own book, Reproductive and Animal Health, co-written with Charles Walters. As this latter collaboration indicates, Fry is also active in Acres USA, the ecological agriculture group founded by Charles Walters in 1970 in Kansas City, Missouri, and now managed by Charles's son, Fred Walters, in Austin, Texas. Acres itself is a key player in the selective recycling of agricultural literature in support of the sustainability agenda. Charles Walters was strongly influenced by the work of University of Missouri soil scientist William Albrecht, who has come up several times today, an early student of the relationship between soil fertility and human and animal health. When Albrecht died in 1974, he bequeathed his papers to Walters, who edited and published them under the general title The Albrecht Papers in four volumes. Foundation Concepts, 1976, followed by Soil Fertility and Animal Health, the suggestively titled Hidden Lessons in Unopened Books, and Enter Without Knocking. Only volume two is still in print. Today, Acres publishes a monthly news magazine as well as an extensive list of books, both originals and reprints. Another title Fry recommended to me was F. Newman Turner's book, Herdsmanship, originally published in England in 1952 and recently reissued by Acres. Turner, incidentally, is described by Philip Conford as Sir Albert Howard's most loyal disciple. Fry told me that he had recently met Newman Turner's son, Martin Turner, at the annual Acres conference, where the younger Turner was a featured speaker. So there you have a direct lineage. Despite their wide separation in time and space, these and other livestock writers espouse principles in line with Fry's own, that soil and forage quality play a dramatic role in livestock development, that animal evaluation should be based on direct observation rather than on pedigree, and that individual development can have a lasting impact on reproductive success. Although these avenues of thinking may seem to venture into some disturbing sociobiological territory, and there are certain contradictions apparent in Fry's own commercialization of these methods, the overall message is in keeping with organic principles in that it puts the power of knowledge in the hands of the producer rather than abstracting it out to external experts. True sustainability means you don't buy any inputs, Fry told me. That applies not just to the land and the grass, but to the livestock that are on that grass. A well-adapted, high-performing herd will be a closed herd, selected for its thriftiness on the grass of your specific farm. Assuming you have some good basic genetics to work with, which most producers will, Fry implies, once they begin raising cattle in conditions where those traits will have the opportunity for expression, you should always take your sire from your herd. Bill McKentley and his family, owners and operators of St. Lawrence Nurseries in Potsdam, New York, grow most of their own food, as well as supplying 75% of their own energy needs through a combination of wind, photovoltaics, and other systems. They have a 200-tree orchard and ship a couple of thousand orders a year of native and edible trees and shrubs, all managed organically. McKentley's wife, Diana, specialized in organic dry bean production for a number of years, for which she built a four-row rotary hoe based on old designs. To support these endeavors, McKentley has a library of 1,500 horticultural and silvicultural books, including, he told me, every book Liberty Hyde Bailey ever put out, which is no small number. Especially in the winter months, McKentley is a voracious reader, consuming as many as 5 books a week. Among his favorites, he cited F.H. King's Farmers of 40 Centuries, 1911, J. Russell Smith's Tree Crops, A Permanent Agriculture from 1929, and David Fairchild's The World Was My Garden, Travels of a Plant Explorer from 1938. For McKentley, this reading enacts a direct and deeply felt connection to what he sees as a key lineage for organic and sustainable horticulture. After training as a biologist, McKentley was mentored in the nursery business by Fred Ashworth, a self-taught plant breeder associated with Cornell University and a co-founder of the North American Fruit Explorers, or NAFEX, publishers of the quarterly journal Pomona. McKentley worked with Ashworth from 1972 until the latter's death in 1977, absorbing from him not just a knowledge of fruit trees, but also a widespread love of reading and information. According to McKentley, Ashworth was an autodidact in every aspect of his career, not just in horticulture, his parents having withheld him from school and supplied him instead with an 1898 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which he read from A to Z. Another manifestation of this literary heritage is NAFIX's lending library of pomological titles, many of them old and out of print, established by Ashworth in the late 1960s. For just a few dollars a month, NAFIX members can borrow S.H. Beach's Apples of New York, 1905, Andrew Jackson Downing's Fruit and Fruit Trees of America, the 760-page edition of 1859, or the 1,908-page edition of 1869, or even William Forsyth's The Culture and Management of Fruit Trees, published in England in 1803, to name just a few titles. The use of old books is very, very important, McKentley told me. They contain information on things like the life cycles of insect pests, which is so important because if you know the life cycle, you can figure out how to control the pest. The best thing about the old books is that people understood the cycles of nature. A lot of information can be gleaned from the past that has just been dropped, he added, citing as an example Ashworth's work in breeding the first blight-resistant potato. But then in a few years, McKentley noted, the chemicals came in and they just dropped it. That's happened over and over. McKentley identified the period from 1880 to 1930 as the age of innovation in American horticulture as well as other fields, an era of acute observation combined with relative freedom from commercial constraint. As he put it, there was so much creativity going on and there was so much slop in the system that anyone could just go in there and do things without getting sat on by the corporations. This kind of activity continues today, McKentley observes, but in a more limited sphere. He pointed to the Small Farmers Journal as an example, a publication in which farmers and experimenters share insights and innovations, mainly, although not exclusively, about farming with horses. How am I doing for time? The use of old books is not without its hazards, McKentley noted. Not everything in them is reliable. Some people write based on hearsay or merely repeat what has been written before without subjecting it to proper scrutiny. What's interesting is watching the books that have been published in the past 25 years and watching them reinvent stuff, he said. But what's worse is watching writers who don't have any in-depth knowledge of farming and they say, oh, this seems reasonable, and they propagate it. The Market Gardener. At a conference for young and beginning farmers held at the Stone Barn Center in upstate New York in December of 2008, organic vegetable grower Elliot Coleman structured his keynote presentation around a book called The Young Market Gardener by Twisco Griner. It was written, Coleman noted, amidst a general enthusiasm for small-scale vegetable production and offered a wealth of practical advice relating to varieties, markets, season extension, and business management, all of which remained highly relevant despite the fact that it had been published more than a century before in 1896. Griner's advice was so good, Coleman joked, that I didn't even have to get born. My mother could have just passed out copies of this book. Coleman is undoubtedly the most dedicated and prominent of the organic farmer old farming book advocates. His book, The New Organic Grower, originally published in 1988 and revised in 1995, includes a chapter on the information resource, guiding novices towards classic as well as contemporary sources. Libraries provide information the way farms provide food, he points out. As early as 1976, Coleman assembled and published an annotated bibliography of biological agriculture, citing French as well as English and American works. Much of this is also included in his later books, which quotes many of these sources throughout its pages. Coleman has also drawn up what he calls the Fertile Dozen, which he gives out to his apprentices, a list of what he regards as the top 12 most important books to be studied by aspiring organic farmers, most of them dating from the mid-20th century. To a certain extent, as you can see, Coleman's Fertile Dozen confirms the genealogy of organic agriculture sketched out by Philip Conford and centering on Sir Albert Howard, Lady Balfour, Dorian Jenks, and the other founders of the Soil Association in England. F.H. King and Edward Faulkner are familiar figures within the U.S. tradition as elaborated by Beeman and Pritchard. There was certainly a golden age of writing about organic agriculture in the 1940s and 50s, Coleman told me. Books like Northbourne's Look to the Land were so well written and astute that they could be republished today as a new work of up-to-date thinking, and few would be aware they were almost 70 years old. But Coleman is such an avid researcher of organic farming history that any top 10 or top 12 list he puts together is continually subject to revision. When I asked for his permission to share the Fertile Dozen list, he offered me a second, mostly 19th century list as a supplement. In another conversation, he told me as a point of interest that three of the four writers he personally had found most influential were women, none of whom appear among the Fertile Dozen: Lady Eve Balfour, R.D.L. O'Brien, and May Bruce. Eliot singled out Miss May Bruce, for instance, as having taught him everything I know about composting. The fourth writer on Coleman's most personally influential list was P.H. Hainsworth, a market gardener based in Wales, whose 1954 work, Agriculture, A New Approach, Coleman told me, was the central inspiration and model for the new organic grower, both in tone and in its scrupulous use of footnotes. Although Chelsea Green forced Coleman to be satisfied with endnotes for his own book. For Coleman, making the case for organic methods has never been just about pointing to his own successes on his own farm. It has always also been about scouring the archive for evidence assembled by others. Like Hainsworth, he regularly cites data published by state experiment stations, mostly from the early 20th century, about issues such as the value of organic matter to soil health and the best strategies for promoting it. A more personal project has been to collect testimony relating to the absence of pest pressures under organically managed, in the sense of being based on the liberal use of well-made compost, market garden operations from before the chemical era, such as those around Paris, London, and New York in the 19th century and earlier. So what conclusions can we draw from this brief survey, and what future lines of inquiry does it suggest? Certainly, this snapshot of pioneering organic farmers' reading habits hints at a more complex and intricate set of trajectories for alternative agricultural history than those we are accustomed to work with. At the very least, oh dear, it's the rereading of that last paragraph. At the very least, this wealth of individual bibliographies and book lists raises all kinds of interesting questions pertaining to sustainable agriculture education, publishing history, and the history of agricultural science, as well as a set of potentially political questions relating to access to knowledge and the role of libraries against the backdrop of the digital revolution. But for the moment, I'd like to leave you with just two observations about the relationship between organic farming and history. And if I have time, one possible framework for guiding future research. The first observation is that organic farmers, particularly the pioneering organic farmers, who had to face a great deal more direct opposition as they began their enterprises than young organic farmers do starting out today, are perhaps primed for a kind of conspiracy theory-oriented approach to history that lends itself very well to the uncovering of lost or semi-forgotten knowledge. It seemed to make sense to the farmers I spoke with to discover old farming books that told a different version of agricultural history than that promulgated and accepted by the extension agents and researchers with whom they were doing symbolic battle. There was both a satisfaction and a logic in this, which is genuinely compelling and I think self-reinforcing. The second point is that there does seem to be a fundamental harmony between the work of organic farming and the work of historical research. Both, after all, involve processes of continually recycling, excavating, composting, covering, and uncovering the past. While all of the farmers I spoke to offered cautions about the use of historical material, you have to have enough knowledge to be able to evaluate what the books are saying, McKentley pointed out, I had to learn how to read between the lines to get into the brain of the writer, Fry said. They all also clearly took great pleasure in this work of historical investigation. Decayed literature makes the richest of all soils, wrote Henry David Thoreau in his journal in the spring of 1852. Despite the legitimate desire of organic farming advocates to present themselves as forward-looking, I would suggest the sustainable farming movements have always borne a unique relationship to history. However mainstream it becomes, it may be that successful alternative in farming, in fact, requires this inquisitive attitude towards what has come before. Do I have time? I want to leave time for questions, though, so then stop.
You should stop fairly soon.
But that tantalizing slide. All right, thank you.
For a while. Questions for our current speaker?
Yeah, in the back. I mean, that's very much my point, right, is that for most of us who haven't been farming for 25, 30 years, to enter the library, I mean, as these other projects have attempted to do, and just sort of start reading, it's a massive task. And you know, maybe 5%, maybe 10%, maybe less than that turns out to be of use. So if we can mobilize the work that's already been done by these farmers to sift through the material and find what's valuable, I think that you know, there's this potential, this set of knowledge there that really is in danger of being lost over the next 20 or 30 years. In terms of specific ideas like that, I mean, does that come from the old literature, or does that come from just like, oh yeah, load it on there, works great? But yeah, I mean, that would be an interesting thing to test, is sort of, are there old canards that keep getting repeated from book to book? Yeah,
Chuck. Mark, do you have a feel for whether there's a parallel wealth of literature, for example, in Italian, Spanish, French, especially German?
Oh yeah, I'm sure there is, definitely. Yeah, and I mean, that, again, that's one of the reasons that Eliot's career is so impressive, is that he reads the stuff in French as well, and I think to some extent the stuff in Spanish. I don't know, I haven't yet come across an organic farmer who's reading the material in German, but it wouldn't surprise me if that were the case. So.
Well, I'll just quickly mention Ploss and Mary Martin.
Yeah.
That Ploss at least reads German and is always talking about the German literature when he gives presentations.
Okay, yeah, I haven't heard him do that, but that's a really good point. Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, quick question. I guess particularly from maybe the Acres USA perspective, there are many views from people like Albrecht and others that are presented almost as gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one thing that I try to do is, you know, I try and look at Albrecht as a scientist who had a very evidence-based approach, and I think, how would Albrecht look at his disciples
mm-hmm.
today?
Mm-hmm.
Would he see his approach being truly carried on, or would he look at it and say, this isn't really my tradition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that. to some extent that this is a kind of like frozen in time impulse rather than a sort of ongoing spirit of scientific inquiry. But I think, you know, it's hard to generalize about the attitude. And what I, in talking to these individuals, what I was really picking up on was this kind of constant testing process, that they would find an idea, go and test it, do, you know, make their own notes, write a book about it, you know, that it's not just this kind of like slogan singing or whatever. But yeah, I mean, there are so many different versions of the uses of the past that maybe it's important to distinguish that the other parts of that attitude which make it more useful or more valuable. Yeah. Thank you.